All right. Where should I start this morning? You know, one of the interesting things about our children's program called Awana is that on Friday nights, we have all kinds of kids from K through 6th grade that gather together. And when you get any group of children in a room, you just need two. As long as you get two in a room, at some point, there's going to be a major disagreement. And so sometimes at Awana, we have kids get into either verbal or sometimes even physical altercations with one another. And I have to be honest with you, the children's ministry team, we developed a discipline policy for them, and the consequences are quite severe sometimes. The penalty can be quite severe. Basically, if you get into a verbal or physical altercation or in some way violate certain rules, like if you cuss somebody out or something like that, then what happens is that you get sent home for the night. And not only that, afterwards, you are grounded from the program until you've had a chance to have talk to you and kind of work it out and come to an agreement. We send this discipline policy home with the children so the parents understand what's going to happen to your kids. And so it doesn't matter if you've attended our church for 5 days or 5 years as a child, but this policy applies to every single one of our children. And oftentimes when kids get in trouble, there's going to be a lot of apologies. There'll be, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do it, I didn't mean to say that. And there's tears that usually come with it, and that's really hard to resist. And some of our leaders in Awana are such soft-hearted, overflowing with the love of Christ, you know, people that they always ask us the question like, well, do we have to be so harsh with the kids? Can't we just forgive them and love them? And sometimes even our commander is the most soft-hearted of all, the Awana commander. And the issue here is that we do love these children, we do forgive them, but the consequences actually help to teach and enforce godly boundaries. Because I want you to think about it this way. If there are no consequences to breaking the rules, what is the message that you send those who violate the rules? The rules don't matter. The rules are not a big deal, that I can get away with it. And on the flip side, what is the message that you send to other children? That this place is not safe. That there is no one who's going to safeguard and protect me when somebody violates the rules against me. And so it's important because even from a very young age, human beings recognize injustice. Our hearts mourn when we see injustice. We get angry. It makes us angry when we read all these different stories in the news. And it should, because there's something in us that still reflects the image of God that was built into us when God made us, that reflects His holiness and justice. We have an innate understanding of that. And so this morning, it oftentimes, as we're going to look at the continuing Old Testament law that God gives after the giving of the Ten Commandments, and oftentimes when we look at the Old Testament law, we see it as if there's this harsh and angry God who gives harsh and angry consequences. But I want you to look at it with different eyes this morning. Instead, to see it as God's strong boundaries designed to protect the children that He loves. And so if you have a Bible, you want to turn in it to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus is the story of being unbound, that as we encounter the glory of God, He sets us free to worship Him and to become His people together. And there's this whole picture in this story of moving people from slavery to freedom. Because in some sense, all of us are slaves to something. We all serve, we all worship something. And if it's not God, it's going to be something else. And so, as we've been learning in this passage today, here God's going to provide some further regulations to the Israelites. And remember, what we're looking at here is not this stern overlord whose approval that we need to earn to become part of His household. But as we learned last time in the Ten Commandments, that He is a loving Father who already accepts His people, who's already saved them, who's already freed them, brought them into His family, and now He's defining the rules and the relationship in His new home based on His character, based on His values as a holy God. And you remember we also talked about last time that there are three types of law that God gave in the Old Testament. There's the ceremonial law, which is things like how you should worship Him in the festivals, in making sacrifices, and all these other worship examples, what you should eat or drink as ways of worshiping God. Then there's also the civic law, which governs Israel as a nation under God. But we know for those two things, they don't apply to us anymore in this New Testament, in the New Covenant, because the ceremonial laws we learn from the New Testament, they all are regulations that point forward to Christ, Colossians 2:17 tells us. And so they no longer apply because Jesus fulfills them. The same with the civic law. The civic laws that govern Israel as a nation don't apply to us today because the church is not a state. We have a king, but our kingdom is spiritual, not national or political. And the last category was the moral law of God. And we learn from the Old Testament that that lasts forever. And in the New Testament, Jesus teaches us because it reflects the very nature, character, and heart of God. So the passage that we're going to look at today contains all ceremonial and civic laws that God gives to specifically the Israelites. But there are very important principles that still apply to us regarding God's heart for how we relate to Him as well as to other people. And so the big idea, if you are very tired this morning, you're going to forget everything that I said, is that these laws that we're reading this morning are God's boundaries designed to protect the Israelites because God is a father who protects the children that he loves. Let me say that again, that God is a father who protects his children, the children that he loves. And I want you to read and see these laws in this passage through that lens this morning. So we're going to pick up where we left off in Exodus chapter 20, verse 22. Excuse me. And the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones, for if you wield your tool on it, you profane it, and you shall not go up by the steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it." What in the world did we just read? I have no idea. Let's end the sermon. Just kidding. All right. So what's happening here is, remember back in verse 19, the Israelites, they kind of, out of their fear, request Moses, "Tell God not to speak to us directly. He might strike us dead if we talk to him." So God actually, in verse 22, stops speaking directly to them and speaks through Moses. "Tell the people, now that you've experienced me, now that you've heard from me, now that you've received my law and the Ten Commandments, respond to me by worshiping me the right way." And in verse 23, he starts off reminding them what not to do. It's a combination of the first two commandments, that I'm the only God, so don't make these false gods of gold and silver to worship, just like these pagan other cultures do. And then in verse 24 and 25, he tells them what to do. So not only what not to do, but what to do. "Wherever you go, make these simple altars of dirt and stone." Now that's weird. And as you read this passage, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us. So the question we have to ask is why? And the whole purpose God is giving them this ceremonial law just for the Israelites is to teach them, don't worship like all these pagan other cultures that worship all kinds of idols, that do all these kinds of things. So he's telling them, first of all, don't cut stones into these nice polished pieces and then build an altar them with your tools. Remember, you just came from a land, Egypt, where you were forced to work as slaves to make these perfect cut geometric stones to build pyramids to false gods and pharaohs. And you're going to go to a land where they build elaborate altars in Cana to idols and for idol worship. So don't do that. Verse 26, then also, when you build an altar, don't build it on top of all these steps leading up to this altar. And you have to understand why. Because practically speaking, in the ancient Near East, a lot of the pagan cultures have kind of like make these altars in these holy places and build up all these steps up towards it. But the priests and the people, how do I say this nicely? Practically, people in the ancient Near East don't wear underwear, okay? And so if you have a dude going up these steps, then what's happening is, well, you know, the priest's going up, and I don't want to see your family jewels. I don't need to see your bare bottom. You know, it's a distraction for me towards worship. And theologically speaking, we do not want to bring God disgrace and dishonor by associating worship of him with your junk, all right? And I know that sounds like a silly request, but many of the pagan cultures of that time, they already did that. They would practice obscene worship to their false gods. They would combine idolatry with ritual prostitution and other indecent acts of exposure as part of their worship. So he's teaching them, don't worship like these pagan people. In this new relationship, in this new covenant, in the giving of these Ten Commandments with God through the law, God is setting boundaries to protect his children from the idolatry of pagan cultures, whether Egypt of the past or the Canaanites to come. And so his guideline when he tells them to build these altars of dirt and stone is, keep it simple. Pile up dirt and rocks that I created, that I provided, instead of what you made with your own hands. Because worship is not about your ownership or your craftsmanship of this altar. The altar and the worship belong to God. It's about his glory, not yours. So keep it simple. And then secondly, keep it holy. Don't pollute it with these pagan practices of indecent exposure and sexual immorality. Glorify my holiness instead of your nakedness. Now, we obviously no longer need to keep the ceremonial laws of Israel. We no longer use literal altars to make burnt offerings to God because Jesus is our ultimate, final, and complete sacrifice once and for all, Hebrews chapter 10 teaches us. But we do, as a people of God, still gather together to worship him. And so there's an important principle for us here that as we gather together as his people to worship, to protect us from idolatry that the world practices, we need to keep our eyes on God instead of these shiny statues, instead of these shiny altars, instead of people's shiny bottoms, right? But the point here is that when we come to worship God, especially together as God's people, where do you keep your eyes focused? I took an informal poll amongst leaders at the Crossing over this past week. I had them just kind of reply by email. About 25 people responded, so that's about 20% of our congregation. And so I think it's a pretty good indicator. And that fell into basically those three categories that we talked about. Idols, mirrors, like look when you look at the altar and you make it about yourself, and then what are some of the nakedness of other people that distract you? And I'm not going to go through every single one, but I want you to measure your own heart this morning. These three principles of worshiping God that God wants us to protect us as his children from idolatry. The first question I want to ask you is, what shiny idols are you distracted by? Are you distracted by shiny idols around you, or your eyes focused on Jesus? You don't build things out of gold or silver, perhaps, or maybe you have a nice Rolex and you like to look at it a lot. I don't know. But for most of us, that's not the case. For some of us, what that shiny idol might look like is, I can't wait for the game after church. And so your eyes are focused on this idol instead of on Jesus during worship. I can't wait for the game. Let's check what's the score. Or I can't wait for lunch. I can't wait to try out that new place that all of us have been longing for. Then your shiny idol is your pleasure and leisure as an idol. For some of us, it's your to-do list that distracts you from worship, that you're focused on what homework you need to get done, what errands you need to get done first, or right after church. And so productivity becomes a shiny idol that distracts us from focusing on Jesus during times of worship together as God's people. For some of us, it's, you know, I like to check my email during church. I like to check my social media and maybe take a quick little photo and put it on my Instagram in the middle of a service. How funny is that? I like to check the score. Or, you know, we have all these electronic devices that alleviate our boredom when the sermon is way too long. And that can become an idol instead of keeping our eyes focused on Jesus. That guy or girl sitting next to me is kind of cute. And you're thinking about, I've been single for so long. This was Pastor Josh's trouble many years before meeting Melissa. And then, so that idea of relationships can be a shiny idol that keeps our eyes focused away from Jesus. But you can see the problem with these shiny idols. And like the Israelites, we approach this altar of worship, and it can be one of two things. Either it's a magnifying glass to help us see Jesus more, or our shiny altar can be a mirror where we're only looking at ourselves. Like the Israelites, instead of, you know, I want to protect you from when you come to worship, keep your eyes focused towards me, that you would see more of me through your altar worship. Or are you going to look at your beautiful altar and only see your great craftsmanship, your handiwork, and look at yourself? So when you come to the altar of worship, are you looking through a magnifying glass to see more of Jesus, or are you looking in a mirror? In other words, do we make worship about me, what we've built, what we give, what I feel? Wow, you know, that's a really nice church building. That's a really nice stage. Those guys, when they do worship, they have great PowerPoint the songs are nice, the message is great, or the flip side, right? I can't worship God because this song sucks, or this message sucks, this preacher sucks. We make worship about ourselves. Or when you come in, I can't worship God because I'm bored, because I'm tired, because I'm cold, because I'm worried about something. Or I'm thinking about what other people around me think, so I don't want to lift up my hands, or I don't want to sing too loud, or I don't want to sing too off-key, because we make worship about me. We make worship about our altar. Or when you approach the altar of worship, you see more of Jesus. That your goal is understanding worship isn't about how I feel, what I think, but that there is a great God. And so we proclaim more of Jesus. We acknowledge more of Jesus. We give glory to Jesus. Are my eyes on myself and my altar or on Him? And then lastly, when we come to worship and we want to see where our eyes are focused, are we a distraction to other people around us? I'm not talking about if you come and you bring kids, your kids into the service. We are a family church. I'm not talking about if you come and you have pain in your heart or in your life that you need to hide it and not distract people. God wants us to love each other and care for each other's needs. But I'm talking about when we elevate my nakedness instead of God's sacredness. Now, you may not come up here and streak down the aisle here, like in nakedness, but you might as well sometimes, with the bad attitude sometimes we come towards worship, with when we fall asleep in the presence of God during worship, when we are talking too loud. That was one of the major distractions that people listed on the worship distractions, is that there are people who don't know how to do an inside voice, so they think we're whispering to each other, but we're distracting everyone around us during our little side conversation. We come in and the music is playing and people are worshiping, and I decide that it's not important to me, that I am a distraction to others. That I want to, when I whip out my little electronic device and I'm playing a game and I think that nobody else notices, everyone around you notices, trust me. Sometimes when we walk in late, and if you came in late this morning, don't feel shamed, okay? There's no walk of shame. But you know, when there's a habitual lack of valuing coming on time and giving God honor, that it tells other people that, you know what, He's not that valuable to me to worship, to come on time or early to worship. And it distracts other people from seeing God instead seeing me. When you come to worship God, where are your eyes focused? Let's move on. Now we switch from ceremonial laws to civic laws. Chapter 21. Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he came in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons and daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, my kids, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl. This is the earliest biblical recording of ear piercing. And he shall be his slave forever. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Let's stop right there. Okay, another very weird passage, right? And to understand what's happening in these first 11 verses, what we're seeing here is that God gives guidelines to protect his children from oppressing one another. Especially, he has consideration towards those who would be considered least in society, most vulnerable in ancient Near East society, like slaves. That's what this whole first section is about. Now, we, through our modern eyes, we see slavery as evil, as we should, because our picture of slavery is when somebody unrighteously steals a person from their family or from their home, declares them their property, dehumanizes them through brutality, destroys them through oppression. But I want you to put yourself in the ancient Near East context, because It's actually much different than what we picture, at least in the Old Testament context. In the ancient Near East, life was hard. There's no social welfare system. There's no government and unemployment benefits. So let's say that for the destitute person who maybe falls into a deep debt, they would sometimes subject themselves to slavery to another person. And that it could actually be very beneficial because they were provided food and shelter and sometimes even a little bit of income. We see that in as early as Genesis chapter 47. Now, so the type of slavery we're talking about is not slavery by being conquered or by being forced into slavery, but we're talking about in the Old Testament this willingness to subject yourself to slavery through a written or verbal contract, often due to having an unpayable debt that you had maybe towards somebody else. And so your choices were, I could either languish in prison for this debt that I owe, or I can actually work my way out of debt through this slavery contract. And so I want you to understand that this is what it's talking about in Exodus here, because if anyone understands the horrors of when slavery is abused, when it's at its most exploitative, it's the Israelites who just came out from under the chains and boots of Egypt, right? So in verses 1 and 2, just as God gives a holy rhythm to our work and rest during the week that we talked about in the Ten Commandments when we talked about the Sabbath, He also sets a pattern to give rest to slaves after 6 years of service on the seventh year that they are to be set free. No strings attached. They don't have to pay a penalty, get out of jail early, free card. It's called a year of Jubilee when all the debts were paid, including a slave. All of those debts were forgiven. And that's explained in more detail in Leviticus chapter 25. And we have a word that describes that. We call it grace. When you are forgiven, when you receive that which you did not earn, that you could not pay for. And so we see God protecting slaves, even in their length of service, that after the seventh year, they were to be set free. Now in verse 3, to protect both the slaves and the masters, when a service contract came to an end, then God stipulated that nobody loses what was rightfully theirs to begin with. So if you went in a slave, that as a single person, then that's how you leave your slavery. If you went in married, then you leave married. The master doesn't get to keep your wife and kids. But and so that protects the slave. But God also stipulates, you know, masters cannot take a slave's family. But sometimes it also protected the master as well. That if you were leaving after 6 years of great service to your master, you couldn't say at the end of your service, you know what, I've worked doubly hard, more than what I owed you. And so you owe me a wife. You owe me this, that, and the other for all my years of labor. Now, in verse 4, it talks about how if the master did in fact provide a wife who was also a slave, now you can't just take her with you when you go, right? It's not like, I completed my job, but since she's my family, like, I'm taking her with me, even though she hasn't paid her debt yet, right? You can't just take it because that person is not yours. They're a gift from the master. Now, we look at that through our Western eyes and feel like, well, that's not very just. What about true love? Doesn't God love marriage and stuff like that? Of course. But I want you to understand that in the ancient Near East, all marriages were arranged at that time. You know, your dad, your mom and dad would pick out your husband and your wives for you. And so the way that it worked is that when a woman was getting married, they had to pay a bride price to marry a woman. A man had to pay a bride price to marry a woman. So for this woman slave, if she's married to another slave, her master would serve as the family to whom that bride price must be paid. And so you can't just walk out of there, I've already paid my debt and I'm taking my wife with me. Because no, you didn't pay the bride price. You probably couldn't afford it as a slave. Bless you. Now in verses 5 through 6, we see though, however, God is not cruel. He's not interested in separating families. He makes provision. So let's say you are recently freed from slavery. You're a guy, you can't afford to pay the bride price for your wife. It's not likely that you saved up a ton of income. If you want to stay, and I want you to see this in the verse, it's very clear, if you love your wife and your kids and your master, you love your master too, then you can instead make a vow to stay and continue to serve them for a lifetime. And then they would seal it with this ceremony involving like piercing your ear to kind of mark that you were for a lifetime. I love my wife and she's a slave to this guy and we decided to stay together and my master is a great master, so I want to stay there. Now I know that sounds really weird to us in our Western eyes, but think of like Alfred Pennyworth, the guy who serves Bruce Wayne Batman. He finds great joy, great satisfaction in serving a good master. He's well-loved and well-provided for. So in that sense, that term of servanthood isn't a curse, but a blessing for him. Now, we switch gears a little bit. In verse 7, sometimes, like slaves, there would be occasions when a family was poor, or maybe they fell on hard times, and they had a son or daughter, or a daughter that they wanted to marry off, but they couldn't afford to pay the daughter's bride price. And what they could do was the dad could, quote-unquote, sell his daughter to the husband as a, quote-unquote, slave. And God protects that person, too. In verse 8, God protects them from being treated as just any other slave who owes a debt. In other words, like he says, like, well, if this daughter that, or this girl that's being sold to become a bride, if you're not going to make them your wife, then you're not allowed to sell them as if they're a regular slave. You couldn't just trick a family like, oh, you can marry my son. You got to pay the bride price. Oh, you can't afford it. Then why don't you sell her to me as your slave? We'll write out the contract and then turn around like, nope, not interested. And then sell this person off as a slave. God protects them from that. God also said that, you know, if that person was trying to be sold off, like your closest kin could redeem them. That means that they could be freed from captivity by paying the ransom price that you cannot pay for yourself. And in verse 9, if you bought her, but it's not for yourself, you're trying to get your son to marry him, then you have to treat that girl like a daughter, not as a slave. You see what's happening here? In every context that this passage is talking about, if you had a daughter that you sold into slavery specifically for the purpose of marriage because you couldn't afford the bride price, God protects that girl. God protects them. And in verse 10 through 11, it's not that God condones this, but if there was like a polygamous marriage, like another woman came into this family, which was very common in the ancient Near East, God also says, you can't deprive that girl of food, of clothes, of intimacy in favor of this new wife. If you deprive them of any of these three, God commands them that she's to be set free without need to be redeemed or to pay a cent for herself. And the whole point here is that God protects his most vulnerable children from being taken advantage of, from being abused, from being neglected, from being treated as less than other people. He gives great dignity to even the least in society. What about you? Do you protect those who are vulnerable? Do you give dignity to your brothers and sisters in Christ who are vulnerable? We are no longer bound by the civic laws of Israel, or we don't live in the Israelite system of slavery and marriage, but these principles reflect God's holiness and his justice, and we too should live them out. Many of you know that I have a little brother. I often tell sermon illustrations about all the ways that I pulled pranks on him and all the ways that I would perform little experiments on him. And he's not a slave to me, but I was a tyrant. I was an oppressor, a pharaoh towards him in many ways. And I joke about it in the sermon illustrations, and my brother, you know, he's okay with it now. But there was this time recently, a few months ago, when I felt a deep conviction in my heart from God. And you know what? You are an oppressor. You oppressed your brother many years ago, and it's not just forgive and forget. You never dealt with it. And so I felt a conviction from God's Spirit to go and have a real conversation, a deep conversation with my little brother. He's also grown up, married, has a son older than my son. But particularly after my son was born, I knew that God was speaking to me to have a hard conversation with my little brother. And I sat him down and said, you know what? Now that we're grown up, I recognize that I was very cruel towards you as a child. Especially after our dad died, it should have been my job to take care of you, to protect you, to nurture you. And I didn't do those things. And so there's two things that I need to say to you. The first is that I repent and I confess my sinfulness towards you. And I want to heal this relationship. And I'm so sorry for the ways that instead of protecting you, I oppressed you and I was cruel towards you. And the second thing I told him is that with my son, I see one of the reasons why I knew that God was speaking to me is with my son, I could feel that God was telling me, this is your second chance. You should have been a protector. You should have been a man that loves and protects your younger brother. And now you have a second chance to get it right. but I don't always know how. So I told my brother, as part of our healing process, would you help me to get it right this time? Would you help me to love and protect my son? And so I want to ask you, how are you an oppressor? Are you kind and just with people who you can influence? Your employees, the team that you work with, your younger siblings, your children, people that you have influence over, like your neighbors, your coworkers, anyone that God has given you some authority or some influence over, are you kind and just towards them? Or do you take advantage of them through your selfishness, through your laziness, through your insecurity? Do you dehumanize people with your words? Do you destroy them with how you treat them? And I'm not just talking about, there's all these ways that we do it, very simple ways, when we're constantly sarcastic with people and putting them down. We oppress people sometimes and we don't even realize how deeply the wounds are that we inflict. And it's not just by the oppression that we commit, but also sometimes by the care that we omit from people. When we deprive someone of their needs, when we withhold love from someone because we're frustrated with them, when we shut down and we give people a cold shoulder to wound them in our passive aggressiveness. We oppress in the ways that we commit as well as the love that we omit from people. How do you need to repent and change this morning? And if you've been oppressed by other people, I want you to hear in this passage God's goodness and His concern in His law, that it is not in His character to turn a blind eye or to forget those who are least, those who are vulnerable, that He sees you, that He hears you, that He is concerned for you, and that He will protect those who feel vulnerable. That there is no one who is getting away with oppressing you. That this is not the end of your story, but that redemption is still being written by our mighty protector God. Let's move on to this last section. Verse 12. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar, that he may die. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him, shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. When men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if that man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, he who struck him shall be clear. Only he shall still have to pay for the loss of his time and shall have him thoroughly healed. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. When the men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him. And he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there's harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. If it gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to the same rule. If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. What are we reading? This is really like culturally contextualized stuff this morning. Basic point of this section of the text is that God gives guidelines to protect His children from unjust violence, particularly perpetrated against one another. So in verses 12 through 14, God says that if you commit genocide, whether you are rich or poor, whether it's against a male or female, then the sentence is death. Now, verse 13 is very important because unlike many cultures in the ancient Near East, God, in the Israelite culture, he actually distinguishes between intent to murder versus accidental manslaughter. That's the first instance of that. Most of the ancient Near East cultures, you kill a person, doesn't matter if you meant to do it or not, all the sentence is the same, death. So God says in cases of accidental manslaughter, a family still had a right to exact revenge, but what God did was he provided cities of refuge. They were basically these cities that were no revenge zones, and God talks about it more in Numbers chapter 35. But it's basically these cities where you could not take revenge against somebody who's a manslaughterer, and to prevent somebody who's rightfully passionate, because their family member is killed, so to prevent that rightful passion from leading to wrongful revenge, particularly allowing that person to go through a fair trial. Now, what happened is, if you're guilty, then you were confined. You're basically, it's like a prison sentence. You had to be confined to that city of refuge until the current high priest of the nation died. So that could be 5 years if the guy was older. It could be 50 years if it was a young high priest. And if you left that sanctuary of the city of refuge, then that family avenger, they could actually still slay you. So the point here is that, on the one hand, God protects somebody who's accidentally committed manslaughter, whose intention was not to murder, not to lie in wait, wasn't pre-planned, wasn't trying to hurt or kill the person. Like, if you accidentally work in the quarry, pushed a rock over a cliff, and it landed on a guy, like a cartoon. Those were cases like that God would protect people. But, at the same time, you did not get off scot-free. God is still just. He still holds us responsible for our negligence and for the loss of life. But you see that God sees, God sees the difference between intentional homicide and manslaughter. Now, God also gave rules regarding if you committed unjust violence in your family or in a slavery situation, whether it's physical or verbal. In verse 15, you strike your parents, death sentence. Verse 16, if you enslave somebody, it's not by mutual agreed upon contract, but you're violating them by stealing them from their family and their home, forcing them into slavery, death sentence. If you curse your mom and dad, that means like cussing them out or cursing them like, may illness or misfortune fall upon you. I wish you were dead. Ever thought that or felt that? The sentence is death. Because remember in the Ten Commandments, the idea was that if you are not able to honor your earthly parents, it's always a reflection of how you are able to honor your heavenly one. And so if you physically and verbally abuse your earthly parents, that's a grave sin against your heavenly one. And slavery by force is also a grave sin against people made in the image of God. So you're starting to get a picture of how God protects his children from unjust violence. Now, if you were to do unjust violence against someone, but it wasn't lethal, it didn't kill them, but it caused permanent damage, God protects those people too. There's a just penalty. And I'm not going to get into all the details, but if you were to fight somebody, like you started to pick a fight and it got heated and you clocked them and you knocked them out cold, if they live, no death penalty. But you would still have to owe them back pay compensate them for the time and the money that they lost from work and from life. But that if you killed them, of course, the penalty was death. Verse 20 and 21, you can discipline your slave or your servant, but you can't kill them. If you do, God will avenge it. Death sentence. Verse 22 to 25, if you get in a fight with somebody else, like Dennis and I were engaging in fisticuffs, and one of us accidentally swung and hit a pregnant person, if that happened, God protects that pregnant woman and their child. Like what happens is, God says that, if something like that happens and the woman causes like a forced early delivery, if there's no harm to the woman or the child, you still have to pay fair compensation. You still have to pay. And the reason why is God produces all these laws and guidelines because it's a deterrent, right, to prevent us from engaging or even kind of moving in that direction of these kinds of violations. But if there is harm to that child or mom, then you have to pay proportionately, and including if you accidentally cause the death of that child or mom, your life is forfeit. See, God holds sacred the dignity of human life made in His image. And in verse 26 to 27, just in case it was unclear, God is saying, it's not okay to hit your slave, but just not kill them. He says, if there's unjust, violent harm that you cause to that person, then you lose all your rights to that slave. They get to go free. So even in cases where there was no death, or if someone wasn't killed, nobody gets away with violence. There's a stiff penalty that God imposes on the Israelite culture as a deterrent to protect. You see that? These are deterrents to protect people who are slaves, people who are pregnant, people who get even into fistfights. And the goal of those deterrents is to make the Israelites think twice. Am I risking doing damage to somebody else? Because if I do, I will have to pay gravely. Excuse me. Sorry. And even in cases where it's violence done by somebody's animal. And I'm not going to get into detail about it, but God protects people. In verse 28 to 30, if you own a bull and it flips out and it gores people to death with its horns, if it's an accident, well, then they just put the animal to death. But if your bull has a history of violence and you've been warned and you didn't deal with it, you didn't put it in a pen, you didn't tell people, you could even sell your bull and kind of like, it's like a used car that's a lemon, right? You don't tell people, oh, it kind of, you know, gets a little violent and kills people. And if you don't warn anybody, then the penalty, God says, is both the ox and the owner. Death penalty. Now, God is still merciful. He tells people that you can pay a ransom price for your life to buy back your life, to redeem your own life. But the point is, whether it was a lethal harm or not, God sets up these deterrent laws to govern and protect the Israelites from unjust violence against one another. So the final thoughts I want to leave you with is, what about you? Are you a violent person? Do you have a tendency to explode? Do you solve things with your fists? Do you punch walls and punch people, anyone that gets in your way when you're mad? Are you somebody who is a life giver or a life taker? What I mean is, do you give life towards people or do you drain it away from people? Do you drain it away with violence through your attitude and words towards people? Maybe you don't solve things with your fist, but you yell and you scream and you rage against people. You threaten people. You control your husband or your wife. Are you a violent aggressor? And how do you need to repent and to change? If you've been abused or violated by someone else, and it sometimes feels like our society or the system turns a blind eye to it, you need to know from this passage there's a God who stands up for you. When by violence someone steals your dignity or your security, your hand or your eye, your life, that God is not powerless, God is not silent, that He demands justice, He provides justice, He is a God who protects. That's the lesson. Many of you know that I moved to California after my father passed away when I was in elementary school. And so I moved here when I was about 8-ish, 9-ish years old. And I had to transfer schools a couple times because I had a lot of issues. I was an angry kid after my dad died. But I have to tell you, as angry as I was, and as often as I got into little fist fights, I remember distinctly in fourth grade, there was a season where I was terrified of going out to recess. Recess, you would think, is like the kid's happiest moment of the day. But the reason why I was so terrified was that there was a boy who was a little bit bigger than me. And for about 2 weeks, he sexually abused me. He would take me from the playground and chase me around and get me into a dark alcove where no one could see. And I was sexually abused several times. And I remember spending about a month. My only goal was to hide. I would hide in the bathroom. I would beg my teacher, can I please just stay in the classroom during recess? And I remember the horror and the shame of that season and wishing somehow that I still had a dad, that there was some strong dad that would protect me. And we often see the Old Testament law as a harsh and angry God who visits harsh and angry consequences on people. But when you have a dad who's willing to put up strong boundaries, who's willing to say, when somebody does something evil against you, I will protect you, I will avenge it, I will prevent it. And we see that God is a God who provides strong boundaries designed to protect us because He loves us as His children. And it's easy to read this passage and just think about it from one side or the other. But one of the things that I shared this morning was that I also realized I'm not just somebody who was violated. I'm also a violator. That we are both the saints as well as the sinners in these stories. And so it's not enough to simply point the finger at other people, what evil they've done to me. And it's not enough even to just point the finger at yourself, what evil I've done to others. That's just the starting point. But the point of God's law is not only to see our sinfulness, the sinfulness of men, but also the holiness, the care, and the protection of a mighty God who loves His kids. And so some of us come this morning with great regret as Jesus convicts us of the ways that we have violated His people and His justice. Fortunately, there is a God who satisfies His own justice with His own mercy and His own sacrifice through His Son. He gave up Jesus for people just like you and me. And as we repent of our idolatry, of our oppression, of our violence, that He is quick to forgive and that He is at work to change us and heal us. And some of us come with great pain this morning. And I want you to know that you can take comfort in the here and now, that there is a God who sees you, who loves you, who protects you, who loves His children and proves that by His provision in the law, in His justice. That there is no one who is getting away with injustice against you. That this is not the end of your story. That redemption is still being written by a mighty God, a mighty dad who protects His kids. And in Revelation 21:4, it promises that there will come a day when God will wipe away every tear from our eyes, that death shall be no more, that there will be no more mourning or crying or pain, for the former things have passed away. There's a God who loves us, who protects us. And even though sometimes we're in the midst of very real pain and suffering, God is not blind. He sees. He is not forgotten. He will be just. He promises. He shows us that He promises through His good regulations. He is a God who is going to avenge us, protect us, and He loves His kids. Would you bow with me in a word of prayer this morning?